The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated March 13/March 20, 2023. Up at the right-hand top corner, it says our 100th year. And as usual, the border of the front cover is in red margin with a narrower white margin. Time, in large block capital letters, is in gray, superimposed upon darker gray, where there is a portrait in black and white of a woman of the year, actor Cate Blanchett. She's resting her head, the right side of her head, on her right hand. She's wearing a black sweater or turtleneck. She has blonde short hair. Don't know the color of her eyes or her lips. They appear to be rouged. That is, the lips are. She's neither grimacing nor frowning nor smiling. She's looking straight at the camera lens. Beginning now with a very short column in the front of the magazine, it says, from the vault, 16 inches, size of the endangered Earth globe. When Time decided to name a planet of the year for 1988 rather than a person, the artist Christo was commissioned to craft a cover image. He wrapped a globe in polyethylene and rope and then drove more than 350 miles to find the perfect setting in which to take a photograph of it. The result, Wrapped Globe, 1988, is a fitting symbol, the issue noted, of Earth's vulnerability to man's reckless ways. Below that is an even shorter item. It shows an old Time cover with a blue, round blue moonish looking object. It has eyes that are wide open, a nose, and a mouth that's slurping something from a bottle. Behind it is another round object with two arms and hands protruding. I think I know what it is. I'll tell you if the column doesn't. The real thing, for a 1950 story on Coca-Cola, the editors hoped CEO Robert Woodruff would appear on the cover. He retorted that the bottle mattered more than he did, resulting in an illustration by Boris Artsebajev, the artist behind the more than 200 iconic covers. So the object, the circular object behind what looks like a blue moon with eyes, nose, and mouth, is red. And what can be seen of the engraving or illustration on it is CO. I think it's a Coca-Cola bottle cap, but it's not authenticated. And here's another column from January 3, 1964, by Martin Luther King Jr. It's entitled Dear Mr. Luce. It does feature a photograph of a Time cover featuring Dr. King's image on it. In 1963, Martin Luther King Jr. once told Time, "The civil rights issue was impressed on the nation in a way that nothing else before had been able to do." In recognition of King's role in the change, the magazine named him Man of the Year. In a January 16, 1964 letter to Time co-founder Henry Luce, King explained what that designation meant to him and to the movement. Dear Mr. Luce, I am deeply honored that your staff and editorial board saw fit to name me as your 37th Man of the Year. In light of the unprecedented peaks of drama, history, and tragedy that characterized the year 1963, I must say that it is with a deep sense of humility that I thank you for so naming me, realizing that there are so many others who justly and deservedly should be accorded such a tribute. I would like to think this is indeed an honor, not to be coveted by me personally, but rather one to be shared by the millions of courageous people who've been caught up in the gallant spirit of the entire freedom movement, even to offering their bodies as personal sacrifices to achieve the human dignity we all seek. This, then, I consider a high tribute to this disciplined legion of nonviolent participants who are working so untiringly to bring the American dream into reality. Permit me also to congratulate Time upon its inclusion in the article of many of the Negro professionals who have achieved success in numerous areas of the mainstream of America that might ordinarily go unnoticed by Time's large audience of readers. This image of the Negro is certainly one that many of us like to see carried in the pages of our national periodicals, for it does much to help grind away the granite-like notions that have obtained for so long that the Negro is not able to take his place in all fields of endeavor, and that he is lazy, shiftless, and without ambition. Again, may I say thanks for the honor you have bestowed upon me and my constituents in the civil rights struggle. It will long be remembered in association with a year that has carved for itself a uniqueness in history. Sincerely yours, Martin Luther King, Jr. Again, that was written in January of 1964. The title of this Time issue is Woman of the Year. Pardon me, it's Women of the Year, with Cate Blanchett as the cover photo image. So I've chosen a few women of the year about whom to read. You may hear more later. First of all, Cate Blanchett, C-A-T-E, Blanchett, B-L-A-N-C-H-E-T-T, Embodying Complexity by Stephanie Zakaric. When Cate Blanchett was around 5, she wrote a mini essay saved for years by her mother and unearthed serendipitously during a recent move, envisioning her possible future as an adult. When I grow up, I would like to be a man. I would still love my family, but I could light a fire and go to work. And when I am bored being a man, I think I'll be just me. Blanchett tells this story over tea in Los Angeles, amused by the kid logic behind it. Yet all those half-fanciful, half-practical dreams have come true for her, at least figuratively. She has played a man more than once, in fact, in movies like Julian Roosevelt's dazzling 2015 manifesto, and as the puckish troubadour Bob Dylan in Todd Haynes' 2007 I'm Not Here. Excuse me, that's I'm Not There. Though she seems to take on projects without a lull, in conversation, it is evident that even when traveling, she lives with her family in England. Her thoughts stay close to home. A teenage son who's looking at universities, a husband, Andrew Upton, with whom she runs the production company Dirty Films. Family is her inner orbit, maybe even the sturdy gravitational pull that makes her work possible. And if you think she cannot light a fire, well, just look at her. For her role in Todd Field's Tar as a top-class composer and conductor who negotiates the world on her own terms, Blanchett has been nominated for an Academy Award for Best Actress, her 7th nomination, and if she wins, her 3rd Oscar. Blanchett's Lydia Tarr is not for you if you believe fictional characters, particularly women, ought to be role models. She is gay, but that doesn't make her nice. She achieves her overscale ambitions, but not without running roughshod over the women around her. Still, she is magnificent. Blanchett, 53, is drawn to multi-shaded characters who do not court our approval. An all-time favorite is Ibsen's compulsive manipulator, Hedda Gabler, whom she's played on stage. But Lydia Tarr, in all her self-destructive glory and compelling unlikability, is like no one else we have ever seen on screen. We are all imperfect creatures, and sometimes we do not want to look at the unthinking, unintentional, inexplicable, ambiguous sides of being female, Blanchett says. We are brave, we are noble, we are generous, we are collaborative. But we are also the dark side of that, because women are complex beings. You cannot hide the truth from by yourself, and that is the human side of Lydia Tarr. We know more about her than she knows about herself. A slithery, shrewd, femme fatale psychiatrist in Nightmare Alley, a 1950s mother who risks everything for another woman's love in Carol, the murdered Irish journalist Veronica Guerin in the film of the same name. Blanchett's roles speak to her preference for teasing nuance, even from characters we think we've figured out. And in person, taking on the perhaps more challenging job of talking about herself, she poses multiple questions on the way to formulating her answers, often looping back to link a previous thought with a new one. Her movie star presence is mildly daunting. Her short, sun-blonde ponytail gives her the air of a punk ballerina. Sitting across a table from her, you realize the special effects glow radiating from her elf sage character Galadriel in Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings trilogy was really just a minor, not very necessary enhancement. But then, her capacity for delight reminds you that she really is of this earth. She talks about a recently discovered hobby, turning ceramic pots on a wheel, confessing that what she mostly does is center the clay and begin the shaping, only to scoop up the half-formed object and begin again. And she cracks up when halfway through a somewhat glam photo shot, she realizes that her black stretch pants have been on backward the entire time. "I think this is the bum part," she says, pointing to two misguided bubbles of fabric pooching out from her hip bones. Back to front pants are the least of anyone's problems, Blanchett knows. The world has been open to her in a way it has not been to others, her work ethic notwithstanding. Sometimes a childhood is marked by grief, and Blanchett's was. Her father died suddenly with no life insurance when she was 10. Her mother and grandmother raised her and her two siblings on their own. But she speaks of her childhood circumstances only glancingly, fully aware of her advantages, including those that come simply with being born a white Australian. In 2012, she was horrified when her home country decided to shunt processing of refugees and asylum seekers offshore to Manus and Nauru, and the shame of it spurred her to action. She's been a UN Goodwill Ambassador since 2016, working with the organization's refugee agency, the UNHCR, to raise awareness and funds to aid refugees worldwide. In the field, she's most struck by the plight of children. You think people have to see this, and they have to hear these people's stories. Blanchett is aware, too, that one global problem connects to another and yet another. The climate crisis, she says, is one of the biggest challenges we face as a species, and she's alarmed by the amount of waste she sees in her line of work in particular. From 2007 to 2012, she and Upton ran the prestigious Sydney Theatre Company, and Blanchett takes great pride in how they repurposed sets and got the whole company involved in conserving resources. She would like to make similar changes in the film industry. Why send a team of location scouts when you can make do with one or two? Why not meet virtually instead of traveling? Blanchett is eager to connect as many dots as possible, knowing changes in one area force us to see the whole with greater clarity. When people talk about gender parity, when they talk about exclusion and inclusion, they always look at the cultural institutions in this country first, she says. So it is upon us to make those changes. It is also incumbent upon those institutions and upon us all to listen, especially when we've made mistakes or failed to act with enough urgency. It is so important to see where people are coming from, she says. We are all in the act of becoming. Life is a constant act of changing and evolving. At the heart of that evolution is creativity, which demands building on past experience, but also being perpetually open to change. Writers are constantly recycling ideas, she says. You cannot say there is an actor alive today who has not been influenced by Liv Ullmann or Bette Davis or Joan Crawford. And even as we draw energy from the women who've come before us, she says, we have a responsibility to all those who will come after us. This is part of what it means to light a fire and to go to work. But the underpinning of it all is to be oneself. Another woman of the year is Ayesha Siddiqua, AYESHA SIDDIQA, Defender of the Planet, by Kyla Mandel. When Ayesha Siddiqua talks about poetry, her face lights up. For the 24-year-old Pakistani human rights and climate defender, poetry represents hope, a way to bring humanity back into the staid, high-level conversations that increasingly occupy her time. At the annual UN Climate Conference in Egypt in November, she shared an original poem titled, "So Much About Your Sustainability, My People Are Dying," as an unvarnished rebuke of leaders' failure to act on climate change, the effects of which were made clear by Pakistan's deadly floods last summer. Her mission is deeply personal. At 14, Siddiqua realized how unsafe the environment can be after witnessing the illness and death, including of her grandparents, that came from her community's polluted river water. At 16, she experienced another awakening as she became aware of the link between human rights and climate change. Growing up in a matriarchal tribal community in eastern Pakistan helped shape her outlook. I was raised with the idea that the earth is a living being and that she gives life to you, and in return you have a responsibility, she says. And I think we collectively have come to a point where we are ignoring the cries of each mother. These realities and values motivate Siddiqua to use her voice to uplift the vulnerable and hold polluters to account. In 2020, Siddiqua co-founded Polluters Out, a global youth activist coalition, and helped launch the Fossil Free University, an activism training course. Now she's working to set up a youth climate justice fund to better distribute philanthropic funding to grassroots activities around the world. And as a research fellow for the Climate Litigation Accelerator Project at New York University's Center for Human Rights and Global Justice, she is helping to create a system of support that breaks down silos between intergovernmental leaders and local activists, as well as pushing to integrate the rights of humans and nature alike into climate law. This work is definitely intergenerational, she says. I'm young now. Tomorrow, I won't be. I absolutely love working with people younger than me to pass on this knowledge so that the chain never breaks. And Megan Rapinoe, M-E-G-A-N space R-A-P-I-N-O-E, Champion of Equal Pay by Sean Gregory. For Megan Rapinoe, reminders of dark moments from the U.S. women's soccer team's protracted fight for equal pay pop up from time to time. In February, when Rapinoe walked into the locker room at Toyota Stadium in Dallas for the She Believes Cup, her mind immediately flashed back to the same tournament in March 2020, when she and her teammates wore their warm-up jerseys inside out to hide the U.S. Soccer Federation crest. They were protesting U.S. Soccer's court filing, which argued that the women did not perform jobs requiring equal skill, effort, and responsibility under similar working conditions compared with players on the men's team. Those difficult times are now behind her. In September, the women's and men's teams signed historic collective bargaining agreements guaranteeing identical pay structures for national team appearances and tournament victories, revenue sharing, and equitable distribution of World Cup prize money. It's a huge step forward to continue to build the sport, says Rapinoe, who won the Golden Ball Award for the top player at the 2019 World Cup in France. The most visible and outspoken member of the back-to-back World Cup winning team, Rapinoe led a movement that's been adopted by players in other countries, including Canada and Spain, and has inspired women across fields to demand equal pay. Rapinoe, 37, will play in her final World Cup this summer in Australia and New Zealand. "I'm all for longevity, but we don't need to drag it," she says. Worldwide, investment is growing in the women's game, threatening U.S. supremacy. While she likely will not be a starter down under, the U.S. may need her late-game punch. "I want our team to feel confident and swaggy and be exactly who we are," Rapinoe says. "But ultimately, I want to win. That, SH space T, is fun." The doctor won't see you now. This is under the health label. Patients are giving up on a lousy system, which only makes things worse, by Jamie Ducharme. You haven't been feeling well lately. You are more tired than usual, a bit sluggish. You wonder if there's something wrong with your diet, or maybe you are anemic. You call your primary care doctor's office to schedule an appointment. They inform you the next available appointment is in 3 weeks, so you wait. And then you wait some more. And then, when you arrive on the day of your appointment, you wait even more. You fill out the mountain of required paperwork, but the doctor still isn't ready to see you. You flip through a magazine for a while, then scroll through your phone until you're finally called. You wait a little longer in a scratchy paper gown, then talk to your physician, if you can call it talking, since she's mostly staring at a computer screen, for all of 10 minutes before you're back out in the lobby with a lab order to have your blood tested. Then you call to set up your blood test, and the waiting process starts over. A few weeks after you get your results, a bill arrives in the mail. You are charged hundreds of dollars for the blood work. The appointment was over in minutes, but your bank account will feel the effects for a long time. Going to the doctor may never be a fun experience, but surely it can be better than it is right now. In 2019, even before the COVID-19 pandemic rocked the foundations of healthcare, an Ipsos survey found 43% of Americans were unsatisfied with their medical system, far more than the 22% of people in the UK and 26% of people in Canada who were unsatisfied with theirs. By 2022, 3 years into the pandemic, just 12% of U.S. adults said health care was handled extremely or very well in the U.S., according to a poll from the Associated Press, NORC, Center for Public Affairs Research. Americans pay a premium for the care they rate so poorly. The U.S. spends more per capita on health care than any other developed country in the world, but has subpar health outcomes. Average life expectancy is lower in the U.S. than in other wealthy nations, and about 60% of U.S. adults have a chronic disease. About 10% of the population does not have health insurance, and the customer service sucks. U.S. patients are tired of waiting weeks or months for appointments that are over in minutes. They are tired of high prices and surprise bills. They are tired of providers who treat them like electronic health record entries rather than people. That could dissuade them from getting medical care at all, and if that happens, America may get a whole lot sicker than it already is. Patients are, in a phrase, burned out. Primary care is supposed to be the bedrock of the U.S. medical system. In theory, patients get annual physicals so doctors can assess their overall health and detect any red flags or refer them to specialists who can before those warning signs become full-blown chronic disease. While experts debate whether everyone needs a checkup each year, studies show that on balance, patients who regularly see a physician tend to be healthier and live longer than those who do not. Yet about a quarter of American adults do not have a primary care provider, and as of 2021, almost 20% had not seen any doctor during the past year. There are many barriers. It can take weeks to get an appointment, particularly in more rural areas where fewer doctors practice, and visits can be costly even for people with insurance. Research shows that during the past year, financial strain caused about 40% of U.S. adults to delay or go without medical care. Plus, people just don't like going. A third of participants in one 2015 study said they'd avoided going to the doctor because they found it unpleasant, citing factors like rude or inattentive providers, long wait times, difficulty finding a convenient appointment. Many people also skipped appointments during the COVID-19 pandemic, largely because of office closures and fears of the virus. But one study found people were more likely to forego doctor's visits during the pandemic if they had had previous poor experiences with health care. People of color, women, and people who are overweight frequently report feeling mistreated by their doctors. Jen Russin, a 48-year-old English teacher and mother of two from Florida, says she cannot remember a single positive experience she has had with a doctor. She struggles to square the $400 her family pays in monthly insurance costs with what she characterizes as a rushed and underwhelming care experience that pales in comparison with the attention her pets get at the veterinarian. "I wish we could see our vet instead, because they really spend a lot of time with their patients," she says. Part of the problem may go back to the way doctors are trained, says Jennifer Tabor, an associate professor of psychological sciences at Kent State University and a co-author of the 2015 study on doctor avoidance. U.S. medical schools do an excellent job of teaching students how to practice medicine, but, she says, they aren't always as good at preparing students to be doctors with all the interpersonal complexity that entails. Patients won't necessarily want to go back to doctors they do not like, she says. Even small gestures like making eye contact with or leaning toward a patient as they speak can help build a strong rapport, Tabor says. The pandemic certainly has not improved bedside manner. It's pushed nearly every element of medical care to the brink and prompted some providers to leave the profession entirely, worsening existing personnel shortages and contributing to an epidemic of physician burnout. According to one recent survey, 30% of U.S. physicians said they felt burned out in late 2022, and about as many said they'd considered leaving the profession in the previous 6 months. Physician burnout only adds to patient burnout, says Dr. Bengt Arnetz, a professor at Michigan State University College of Human Medicine, who researches how to improve primary care. Providers feel stressed, burned out, less empathetic. A lot of times they don't engage with the patient, and the patient wants to be engaged, Arnetz says. But these problems did not start with the pandemic, says Lori Knutson, an executive director of the Whole Health Institute, a nonprofit focused on improving healthcare delivery. We should all be honest, she says, about the fact that healthcare has been slowly imploding for a period of time. It is impossible to explain problems with U.S. health care without talking about insurance. U.S. patients pay more out of pocket for health care than people in other wealthy developed countries, most of which offer some form of universal health coverage. The insurance system is also endlessly confusing, says Dr. Ativ Mehrotra, a professor of health school policy at Harvard Medical School. Doctors may not know how much the tests they are recommending cost, particularly when every patient has a different type and level of coverage. So surprise bills are common and so hard to understand. Patients often have to spend hours on the phone seeking clarity from their insurance providers. One 2020 study estimated dealing with insurance companies costs the U.S. more than $20 billion annually in lost productivity. How doctors get paid affects the patient experience, too. Many health systems pay physicians based on how many appointments and procedures they squeeze in, which rewards lightning-fast visits over those that are about the whole person and not just what's wrong with them, Knutson says. This system can also incentivize doctors to recommend tests and procedures that are not strictly necessary, which leads to extra costs and hassle for patients and added strain on the healthcare system. Here, too, insurance is part of the problem. Doctors in primary care or family medicine often make significantly less than specialists, in part because their services are reimbursed at lower rates. That dissuades some medical school graduates, particularly those saddled with debts, from entering general medicine, which contributes to shortages in the medical fields patients are most likely to need on a regular basis. When there are not enough doctors to go around, appointments get scarcer, and physicians become overworked, rushing from appointment to appointment and drowning in paperwork. Some simple solutions exist. In a study published in 2020, Arnetz and his colleagues analyzed what happened when one small medical clinic made minor tweaks to its operations, such as reassigning some of the main provider's administrative duties to nurses or medical assistants and adding short team meetings to delegate tasks for the day. After 2 weeks, the clinic scored higher than a comparison clinic on measures of efficiency, contributing to better patient and provider satisfaction. Traditional medical offices could also take cues from the services patients are increasingly gravitating toward, says Pearl McElfish, who researches health services at the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences. Patients who can afford it are flocking to startups offering perks like same-day appointments and flat-rate monthly memberships. And one 2018 study co-authored by Mehrotra found visits to urgent care clinics where patients can walk in instead of waiting for weeks increased by more than 100% from 2008 to 2015 among privately insured U.S. adults. During roughly the same period, primary care visits dropped 24%. During the pandemic, urgent care centers only became more popular, as did telehealth. Currently, the traditional system is not meeting the needs of many patients, Mehrotra says. Patients are voting with their feet and going to these other care sites. The trouble with convenience-first medical care, however, is that it is often issue-specific. If you go in to get a flu shot, you'll get that vaccine and then be on your way. The clinician is unlikely to make sure you are up to date on other shots or perform recommended screenings, the kind of preventive care that can fend off bigger issues down the line. On the other hand, these newer options can put pressure on existing providers to be a bit more patient-centric, Mehrotra says. Traditional medical offices could make some changes right away, without waiting for big structural overhauls, he says. They could offer walk-in-only hours to treat people without appointments, text patients when the doctor is ready to see them, and include clear explanations on bills so patients understand what they are paying for. Even small shifts like these could make significant differences to patients. The stakes are high. Ashley, who's 35 and asked to use only her first name to protect her privacy, has a gene mutation that heightens her risk of breast cancer and is supposed to get an annual mammogram and 2 ultrasounds per year. But she has to move frequently for her job in academia and has not had her test done in 4 years because she got so fed up with the arduous process of finding new doctors, transferring medical records, and dealing with insurance every time she moves. The barriers were enough that I just kept putting it off, she says. Burned out patients may retreat from the institutions that made them feel that way. Ashley says she's considering a preventive double mastectomy, a surgery she may have needed anyway because of her genetic predisposition, but one made more appealing by her desire to stop dealing with pain-in-the-butt medical appointments. Russin from Florida says she has felt tempted to cancel her family's insurance and go to the doctor only when absolutely necessary, though she has never acted on the urge. Other patients, however, may walk away from the healthcare system entirely. It may not be the wisest or healthiest response, but it is a human one. Jamie Ducharme wrote that article, and now to Time Off by Judy Berman. So it will be reviews. Ask ChatGPT to write a fictionalized biography of Fleetwood Mac in the style of an oral history, and the bot will respond with a flurry of hilariously realistic cliches about the wild ride that is rock stardom. We were making records that people really connected with, says one imagined band member. It was a wonderful feeling. Another observes that the success was great, but it also came with a lot of pressure. This uncanny valley conversation could have been ripped from the pages of Taylor Jenks Reid's 2019 novel, Daisy Jones and the Six. Structured as an oral history and openly influenced by Fleetwood Mac's tumultuous romances, it traces the slow rise and abrupt combustion of a 1970s L.A. rock band. I felt connected to them in a way that I had not felt connected to anyone before. Stevie Nicks, analog Daisy Jones, recalls, of a crowd at one show. Hedonistic drummer Warren explains that being at the top is not always fun, because that's when you've got the pressure. With its unusual format, retro glamour, and characters both inspired by real people and generic to rock lore, Reed's book is a vibe, a mood, an aesthetic. Canyon Core? Figure in the will they or won't they tension between Daisy and the Sixes, married leader Billy Dunn, and you will understand its enormous appeal to the romance mavens of Book Talk, who helped Daisy Jones sell more than a million copies. Now the book is back on bestseller lists in advance of a TV adaptation, which debuted March 3 on Amazon Prime Video. Produced by Reese Witherspoon's Hello Sunshine, a company known for transforming buzzy books like Big Little Lies and Little Fires Everywhere into small-screen smashes, and starring genuine rock royalty, Elvis's granddaughter, Riley Keough, the 10-part musical drama reportedly spared no expense. The New York Times inventoried its wardrobe, 250 ensembles a night at one point, music, 25 original songs with input from Phoebe Bridgers, Marcus Mumford, and more, and publicity machine, at least 30 flacks. Yet the series is more hollow and hackneyed than the novel. Not that this makes either incarnation a rarity among stories about musicians. Shallow portraits of pop genius are the norm across narrative art forms, which are poorly equipped to capture the ineffable qualities of music, and whose creators so often seem to be working backward from larger-than-life personas instead of real people. Framed as a documentary looking back on Daisy Jones and the Six, 2 decades after their onstage implosion in 1977, the show begins like most episodes of Behind the Music, with the protagonists' rough childhoods. No one wants to hear your voice, poor little rich girl Daisy's mother hisses when her daughter's singing interrupts a party. Billy, Sam Claflin, a working-class Pittsburgh dreamer, fronts his younger brother Graham's, Will Harrison, high school garage act as a favor, but gets serious about music after a heartbreaking run-in with their estranged father. The show barely fleshes out the other people in the Dunn's bluesy band. In Eagles terms, bassist Eddie, Josh Whitehouse, is the bitter Don Felder to Billy's Glenn Frey. Warren, Sebastian Chacon, digs partying chicks and partying with chicks. Keyboardist Karen, Suki Waterhouse, is a slightly more layered character in that she underplays her beauty in order to be taken seriously in a sexist industry. The adaptation cuts the lineup from the book 6 to 5, which is only a problem because the band is still called The Six. Brought in by ace producer Teddy Price, Tom Wright, Daisy meshes and clashes with Billy immediately. If only the show, like the book, did not emphasize to the point of redundancy the way Daisy, a casual drug abuser, mirrors Billy, who gets sober after his alcohol-fueled infidelity on an early tour nearly loses him his ride-or-die wife, Camilla Marone, and baby daughter. Adapted by 500 Days of Summer writers Scott Neustadter and Michael H. Weber, Daisy Jones does hit a few high notes. Keough, that's K-E-O-U-G-H, grounds what could have been an ethereal sad girl in intelligence and drive, but in a choice that suggests a star is born, was on the show's mood board. Claflin's Billy is nothing but a human wince. While the wigs are awful, pity Timothy Oliphant as a fluffy-haired manager, the costumes dazzle. There's no shallow-level single, but songwriter Blake Mills salvages cringy lyrics from the book with arrangements that vary from whispery folk to pop rock in the Rumors mold. Sadly, Neustadter and Weber also ratchet up the drama with more cheating, more self-destruction, more conflict, changes that erase all pre-existing nuance, including Reed's shrewd divergence from tired female rivalry storylines. The acting is uneven. Scripts maintain the book's silliest platitudes and reinforce its strange misconception that 75% of songwriting, excuse me, that's a 9, 95% of songwriting is scribbling lyrics in a notebook. Crowd scenes look shoddy. Characters constantly marvel at the greatness of live performances that do not come across as particularly special. Pop music at its best traffics in a messy form of transcendence. It is the clattering percussion of drumsticks tapping a Coke bottle in the Dixie cups, Ico, Ico, or Eco, Eco, the tremor in Patti Smith's voice on Dancing Barefoot, the wistful way Nix elongates the word home in Gold Dust Woman, to borrow a few Daisy Jones needle drops. Stories tangential to feeling, which makes writing good fiction about the alchemy of rock even harder than dancing about architecture. At least dance and architecture are both non-narrative art forms. Reed, Neustadter, and Weber are hardly the first creators to struggle with this challenge. Salman Rushdie and Jonathan Lethem wrote their most self-indulgent novels, The Ground Beneath Her Feet and You Don't Love Me Yet, respectively, about musicians. Co-creators Martin Scorsese and Mick Jagger could not save HBO's Vinyl from the absurdity of scenes like one where a white record executive accidentally witnesses the birth of hip-hop. The best pop stories approach music's mythos differently. Sometimes they spoof the idea of genius, as This Is Spinal Tap so famously did. Sometimes they evade it. Fox's Empire, which recreated King Lear succession drama at a hip-hop record label, was a show about power more than art. Cameron Crowe's beloved 2000 film, Almost Famous, is really a coming-of-age story, more memorable for giving us Billy Crudup screaming, "I am a golden god," from a rooftop than for anything his band did on stage. It is rarer and much harder to do justice to the magic of music making. For the most recent edition of A Star Is Born, one standout song and two passionate performances yielded a solid facsimile. Series like HBO Max's Rap !T and Peacock's We Are Lady Parts, which follow young female artists launching careers outside the mainstream, thrive on the ecstasy of collaboration. Todd Haynes, the filmmaker between two brilliant portraits of musical genius, prismatic Bob Dylan biopic I'm Not There, and Velvet Goldmine, which fictionalizes glam-era Bowie, filters rock innovators through the life-altering fantasies they inspire in their fans. Short on imagination and intentional humor, Daisy Jones tries with painful earnestness to capture an inchoate love between two geniuses making a classic album. It is a tightrope walk on a wire made of dental floss. The only possible way to make it work is through protagonists built from scratch rather than sanded down, as Daisy and Billy are, from public images made colossal by decades of breathless media coverage, industry lore, and fan worship. Formulating a generic alternate universe, Fleetwood Mac is a project for AI. Human artists capable of sublimating real emotion and experience have got to do better. Judy Berman wrote that review. Here's another review by Zakarik. Stephanie Zakarik. A tortured detective, a devious villain, and a coat to die for. It is hard to love a man who's so obsessed with his work he cannot leave it at the office, but it helps if he's played by Idris Elba. In Luther, the Fallen Sun, that's S-U-N, a movie standalone adapted from the TV series, Elba's London detective John Luther hops on a case that might spell the end for him, given his history of getting a bit too cozy with the criminals he's investigating, though you do not need to have seen the show to get the gist. a twisted mastermind played by Andy Serkis in a truly terrifying wig that swerves around his pate like a curled-up forest animal, is close to finalizing a horrific plan that involves cyber blackmail, kidnapping, and teenagers locked in dank cages. You know, the usual grim TV detective folderol, but Luther's sniffing a little too close to this pungent scheme. A quick phone call to the right people, and the perpetually self-tortured and not 100% moral Luther is unceremoniously whisked behind bars, which seems to suit plenty of his colleagues just fine, including Cynthia Erivo's Odette Rain, who rises in the ranks with his removal. Will Luther bust out in time to stop the sicko villain and stand boldly atop a tall building, his supple but manly tweed coat swirling around him in the wind? Sometimes The Fallen Sun, directed by Jamie Payne and written by the show's creator, Neil Cross, is genuinely creepy in its brooding vision of all the ways an evil genius might manipulate our preoccupation with staring at screens. Other times it is just eye-roll inducing. You could build a drinking game around the number of times one imperiled teen calls out, "Mom!" even as her poor mother is doing her damnedest to save her. But the mere presence of Elba's Luther, with his haunted gaze, his voice as plush as the finest antique Persian carpet, is enough to keep the fallen sun from sinking on him. Troubled in tweed is a good look. And here is another Stephanie Zakaric review, Fishing for Meaning. We live in such rushed and anxious times, most of us probably spend more energy worrying about the imperiled environment than we do savoring its beauty. Blueback, that's one word, blueback, adapted by director Robert Connolly from a novel by Tim Winton, is a gentle, gorgeously filmed story about a fraught relationship between a mother and daughter and the cause that unites them. The setting, alluring by itself, is the Western Australian coast, its waters teeming with lustrous striped fish and undulating plant life. Abby Mia Wasikowska is a marine biologist who is called home to that coast when her mother Dora suffers a serious stroke. The story of how Abby found her life's calling unfolds in flashback, focusing largely on her teenage years, where she is played by newcomer Ilsa Fogg, F-O-G-G. During that period, Dora, a feisty Radha Mitchell, is focused dually on preserving endangered coastal waters and instilling in her daughter a love of the natural world. The living, swimming metaphor for that world is a wild blue grouper, a mighty, long-lived fish with oversized cartoon lips and a plaintive expression, discovered by Dora and Abby when the latter is still a child, just learning to dive into the waters near her home. Abby christens this noble creature Blueback, and her connection with him through the years anchors a story that is as gently compelling as the allure of sun-warmed water, but also as urgent as a ticking clock. Stephanie Zakaric writes a review, a boxing franchise that feels like a gift again. This will be a bridge now that our lives revolve around tiny screens tailored to our individual likes and dislikes. The act of trying to please a crowd, specifically a crowd of moviegoers gathered at an actual theater, has become more a noble pursuit than a purely money-grubbing one. Relying on the popularity of a franchise is one way to pack them in, but those of us who care about movies and about the experience of seeing them together have become understandably wary of that strategy. We are IP weary. Is it even possible at this point to build a better sequel? Creed III, Michael B. Jordan's directorial debut, a sequel to a sequel to a sequel, tracing back to the 1976 boxing blockbuster Rocky, proves that it is. Jordan also reprises the role of Adonis Donnie Creed. The underdog boxing superstar, he played first in Ryan Coogler's 2015 Creed, a brash surprise. And later in the less satisfying 2018 Creed 2. As both actor and director, Jordan pulls off some fancy footwork in Creed 3. He has a knack for melodrama with all its heightened emotional textures, but he's careful to keep it in check, buffing it down till it glows. The story is by Ryan Coogler. The script was written by Kenan Coogler, his brother, and Zach Balin. The boxing sequences are sharp-elbowed, smartly edited, and beautiful in their own pitiless way. In one brief slow-motion sequence, droplets of sweat fly into the air like wayward Swarovski crystals as two angry bruisers beat the hell out of each other. It is the sort of effect, artificial as a drawn-on beauty mark, that the big screen was made for. The climatic fight of Creed III leaves you feeling good for about 30 seconds, and then a note of melancholy wafts into the ring. The winner's victory is bittersweet. The formula Creed III springs from is as familiar as your basic right hook, but instead of trying to buck the convention, Jordan leans right into it. He's playing to the crowd all right, but maybe it's about time someone gave some thought to what we might want to see. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.